Story Knife is the name given to the first production of the Tuma Theater. Tuma in the Yupik language means the way, path, or trail. Hello, and welcome to this special program about the Tuma Theater, the 11 University of Alaska Native students who performed in it, and the two directors who gave it form. I'm Paula Schiller, and I'll be your host for the next hour. I saw the first performance of Story Knife on March 12, 1979, the opening day of the Festival of Native Arts on the Fairbanks campus. KUAC-FM recorded the second performance the following Friday, and you'll be hearing part of that later. What follows is not simply the soundtrack of a stage presentation. We've gone a little farther to help set the scene and let you in on some of the thoughts and feelings that went into making Story Knife. Here are the two Tuma Theater directors, first faculty advisor Doug Nancaro, followed by student director Josh Weiser.
One of the things that we attempted to do was to portray Native folk tales and the dances and the songs and to put them together in a way that would be most acceptable to an audience, using a contemporary form of oral interpretation, but not doing the traditional system of reading from text on a stand and working only with the voice. We thought that there had to be some imagery for the audience, and it's something that Native audiences are used to in the first place. So we wanted to do two things. We wanted our Native audiences to see their heritage on the stage, and we wanted our non-Native audiences to become more aware of the Native heritage on the stage. And in part, we gave the Natives some dances that they were familiar with, and we did some of our stories in the language that they were familiar with, and our non-Native audiences were able to enjoy songs that were done in English, as well as to get a feeling from the Native languages.
I'm sure Doug will agree that up to 2 days prior to the show, we were still pulling our hair out and aging rapidly, wondering if we were going to have a show indeed. And, you know, things were not tight, and as tight as they ever could be, as much as in terms of projection and how they're delivered themselves on stage, we weren't sure what would happen with an audience. Of course, fortunate, as you've seen and other people saw, the reverse was true.
I will hazard to say that part of what I know what I liked, and I think what other people liked, is that it wasn't so awfully tight. They forgot some of the lines. They missed a line and smiled in embarrassment, and some of it you couldn't hear, and that just pulled the audience right to them, I think.
I tell you, the quality that I saw, and you'd only be able to pick this up as if you've ever spent any time in any Native villages, which I have in the Bethel region, and you see a childlikeness among the people, where there's a great joy taking in what maybe Western man would pass off as, well, you just don't have that much, it's not that important. But what can go on around a little dinner table, where a piece of cardboard is put out and a frozen pikefish, and they're cutting the pikefish, and little kids are all around and taking bits of pikefish and putting it in the seal oil, and what goes on just in walking day to day throughout the village, hanging up clothes or whatever, there is a natural rhythm and a drama which is going on all the time, a genuineness about people, and it's that same thing that we saw on stage, a genuineness.
You worry me a little bit when you talk about tightening it up, though, and maybe polishing it. Could you get too fancy with it, do you think?
We'd kill it.
Yeah, we would destroy it. We would totally destroy it if we got too tight with it, because part of the thing has been to allow the students to enjoy themselves, to select things that they think that they can do the best job with.
One of the most striking things, and another something that drew me to the performers, was several of them got up and delivered a personal statement to the audience, and they seemed like it was like it was a painful thing for them to do, but something that they felt they had to do. How was that?
Yeah, that was the most painful aspect there.
It was extremely painful, and the have to is probably because I demanded it. But the personal statements were really that, and they didn't feel that they should be out in front of an audience. But I thought that perhaps the audience needed to get more of a feeling about what they were, what they felt, and the maybe uncomfortable position they had at being at the university, or the lack of culture, the dying of culture, and it made the rest of the stories that followed more or much more clear, having this feeling. And yes, it was. But now that they've all done it, they feel it's important to do that. That's the thing that makes that show, are those personal statements.
Now, please imagine a bare stage. Its dark velvet curtain is the only backdrop. The lights come up on three young people off to one side. They are the singers. The two young women wear gusbucks, headdresses, mukluks, and Levi's. The young man is in a dance shirt and a fur dance hat. They sing as other young people enter. And one by one, they step forward to make those personal statements that are so hard for them to say, yet so effective. Later, another young woman, wearing a Tsimshian robe, will enter from the opposite direction to introduce us to the story knife. But this is how it begins.
Atatamani yudamaku Sapaklak sudoy yung nakasal Doitamani dotnduay Ang uyang nakdut Bitkakulut ng klub Tamani angutetuai tamakudineting bisag na raytoy anguyagamak bitakutagamak churutagan itlu toy totnduai Tamani angas kuduai tunirilunduai yutasirikar naurai akatamani doitunduai angu yaginaktut bitakulutinklu
Small community is very meaningful and peaceful in comparison to the life we live in the city.
A new beginning in expressing our way of life is always important. Today, many young Native Americans are enrolled in institutions of higher education, facing a new culture at times. Makes one feel a sense of weakness, but through individual strength and integrity, our future events are optimistic. A greater sense of strength is accomplished through group endeavors.
During my Christmas break, a very special group of people came to my hometown. Through the presentation of the Nelson Island dancers, I realized for the first time my uniqueness as a Native. I realized that my culture has been robbed in more ways than one. And tonight, I'd like to express my gratitude to the Duma Theater for helping me to experience and understand a little bit more of my background.
My village of Beaver has a very unusual population. I have had the experience of many cultures, Swedish, French, Norwegian, Japanese, Athabascans, and Eskimos. Thus, it has been easier for me to adapt to the white culture.
Trying to be part of two cultures at the same time is sometimes a very depressing experience. I always wonder, what should I do? My culture is what my parents are. I'm an Eskimo, and Eskimos have their own ideas, beliefs, and whatever. My other culture is what I have learned in school. And I know as my years go by, I'll someday find my place in this world.
Even though I lived in Fairbanks most of my life, I consider my hometown to be Stevens Village, which is where my mother is from. My summers were spent fishing along the Yukon River with my family, and I always look forward to moving over after school got out. I'm very thankful to have lived that way of life, and those memories will always be a part of me.
Sometimes it is hard to try and identify yourself in a whole group. Eskimo language and Eskimo dances bring out special spirits to the natives because they make us express our true wholeness.
Southeastern Alaska, we have the Tsimshian, Haida, Tlingit, and Eyak. The western coastal region is made up of the Sukpiak, Aleut, and the central Yupik. In the northern region are found the Siberian Yupik and the Inupiak. And in the interior, we find the many Athabascan groups. Our cultures are rich in folklore. These songs, dances, and tales give us a feeling of continuity. The Tuma Theater is part of that continuum and represents for us a way to express our heritage. In the next hour, we will share with you, through voice, song, and dance, a part of our rich native culture. Some of our stories tell of the people and the land. Some depict the effect that animals play in our culture, and still others leave us with a message of morality. Join with us now as we present, both in Yupik and English, a story night.
I am going to go to the house. Nukas agnatul tag tam kan pagnatik ay dakser mani clinic ay pachumi kamat natrah kam tam malre dos ikawat ay patang kamat nilingan ani ay dakt chokaklu ni mani chokaklu dos nukas pek pak na yomi tamon pak ulaglu usani tam agnam kuyalo ni chaknak ikayosiniki Ikayo duku totin nimeni trusuku nxluku qanum jiluutiklu tos unungubakkan inaxliniluutik unnumainan nagani nukaspertan dubaktormaatin anguqatarluni takkna tos anguqatarpakkami makluni ammiku sagi ulaalxanniu aqnaqaptu tasuqatarti nukaspertan kiyu yuqtartuqataq niluuni aqnalluguk fukkamian fukkaqlugu annigamis yuqnamaktaqngan aqnariikaak nankili ampiam tuuknani nukasperaptuq tiin aqnaqtaana tiitnigangxtuttuq nukaspertana liingallaaki liqumvagiullagluni sinuppaistuq nuppaistuqmaat qamna kiinalikpallaagallerat toos aptuq kiin ipxtsaqqiqa qamna amliam tuuknani toospungvagiullaami nupliinarluni itertuq iterngamillu kiinalikpallaagilleri nuppaalluni itertuqmaatin aqnaqtaani inangqallere toos inangqanlli ummiongtiarnaluni qaillunanllerkamiini kiinglimiinunagluni inertuq toos inangqainananerani aqnaqtaani maakskili utuskamiatsiani kiinallinianllugu kanaqlu qantamq tuulluni yaavat jiitiinatsianum liilugu toosuani jiiti tiuqataaqertsiluugu nukaspertan qunglullaakil yaaliingalliimi toos nuk aqnaqtaun aliingallaaglun nuppaerluni inglimiinunak aqqerluni inartliiniluuni toos uitaaqallani nukaspertan qunguvagiullaami tuammakkluni атгуниарлугу пилугни тууллугу исхатнил тууллугу анпти катариарлани яав тамигмун пилхани арина маккарлунарту тасиуқатарти тииннисхатн тууси нукасперкиугу илууккаар тасхат исхатумни иумтаат кавиттаа аа ангамилтой яав ки яав каяни усааллааглугу мэгмэнх атхахтлааглугу килааглунаяа наасиниилуни айянэнгани луни нискэлямай алинганак пагах нукаспертан алин куяалуни такнераяалхэрминик писиинилиуни тоо
My mother just told the story of the lady who liked to chew ears in her native Yupik tongue. This story may be likened to the white culture's parable in which curiosity killed the cat. You will understand what I mean as I now tell you the story in Yupik, in English, excuse me. One day, a hunter was paddling up the river when he came to two mud houses on each side of the river. When he got near to the mud houses, a lady from each house emerged from inside. The hunter noticed right away that they were chewing something. Both the ladies asked him to stay at their house. The hunter, then not sure of what he was going to do, said, "Show me what you are chewing." He noticed that the other lady really seemed to enjoy what she was chewing, so he paddled over to her side. All evening he stayed with her, telling stories. He had supper till it was getting too late to stay up anymore. Later on during the night, he awoke and had to go very badly. So he got up to go, and the lady asked him where he was going. He told her. When he got done, the other lady came out and told him he better hurry and get out of the house. He asked why. She told him to listen. So he held his breath and listened. He heard metal going down another metal, and he asked, "Is that the sound of sharpening knife?" She said yes and told him to hurry because he'd soon lose his ears. So he went in, and the noise stopped right away. He went over to his bed, lay down, closed his eyes, and waited a long time. Afterward, the lady reached under her bed and brought out a knife. She then got a basket and put it under his head and was about to cut off his ears when the man moved. She then got very still, lay down, and waited again. The hunter, now believing the other lady, got up, put on his boots, and pretended to get something from his pack. He jumped up and ran out the door. The lady got up really fast and asked him, "Where are you going in such a hurry? Why are you taking all your things?" The hunter, now very chilled, said he had a stomachache and needed to hurry outside because he had something in his pack that would ease the pain. The lady believed him. As soon as the hunter came out, he ran for his kayak and pushed it down as fast as he could into the river. When he was about to get into the kayak, he heard that lady rushing out of her house. His back got really chilled, and he hurried away down the river, not daring to look back. Then he heard in the distance, "Oh, darn, missed again." So he paddled on and on, not once daring to look back or stop.
Did you think you were taking a risk in having a story, a fairly long story, told completely in the Yupik language, which more than half your audience wouldn't understand?
Yes, it was a risk. We really weren't sure how the audience would react to that much of the Yupik language. And then I believe that the non-white audience reacted not only off of what they saw on the stage, but the Yupik members of the audience. They laughed, mm-hmm. They enjoyed it. It was a warm feeling throughout the auditorium so that everybody could enjoy that. And the thing is that we put together a very traditional setting, that is the way a story is told. And that's something that a lot of people were not used to.
Describe the setting for us.
Okay, the setting being a woman coming forward with her story knife and knocking it on the stage or making circles, and then the villagers, seeing that a story is going to be told, coming around and preparing to have this very exact, passed down, hand-by-hand story, or mouth-by-mouth story over generations.
It was a spontaneous setting, yeah. In that, as exactly as one would see it in a village, where someone pulls out a story knife and starts drawing patterns in the snow. And, the knife which she used is a traditional story knife which is used.
You could describe that for me if you could. Too.
Traditionally, they're kind of curved like a butter knife, only that the curve is long and arch. It's just more like a buck knife. And it's...
Made of ivory?
Traditionally made of ivory, but the kids started losing them so much that they turned to butter knives instead, mm-hmm. out in the villages. But we have one traditional ivory knife, and also because of our first performance, one Tlingit carver who was present was so impressed by our show that he made us a wooden story knife with each of the scenes of the play carved on the knife itself. So that was something.
And the knife is used, it augments gestures. It's also writing in the snow or...
Either snow or in the mud. If it's in the mud during the summertime, you hear the between the stories, there's always a saliva in the mouth and the spit, and cover it up with a story knife, and it's changing scenes. So the story knife, there's certain gestures that mean grandma, grandpa, certain things that mean an old, your house, my house, river, plane. It's a whole language.
Right, but it's a symbol, too, for the speaker, and the story knife is passed, and whoever holds the story knife is the storyteller. Like the gavel is mm-hmm. passed in a meeting. And that also the symbols on it represent the types of stories that are being told. It's sort of a system of remembrance.
Takapam pintawa, ih pintingayo,
She told Raven,
I don't think you can make it. It is too far for you and you will get tired and fall into the salt water.
Raven said,
oh, I can make it all right. I won't get tired.
Ha! Swan was doubtful, but they started out in company with a large group of swans. Soon, Raven began to get tired. He could hardly fly. Finally, he jumped on the back of Swan and rode that way for a while. Soon, Swan tired from carrying him. Raven then jumped on the back of another swan and rode until she too was tired. Then he jumped on the back of another, and so on. All this time, they were flying over a great salt water. Finally, Raven was too tired to ride any farther. He fell off and went flapping down toward the sea. The swans continued flying southward, leaving him behind. Down, down, down went Raven. Far below, he spied a little pile of rocks jutting up from the sea. He sat there and rested. A big fish used to play about these rocks. He had a child. When the child climbed upon the rocks, Raven caught it. Big Fish swam up and begged for his child. Raven said,
no, it's mine. I've got to keep it.
Then he told Big Fish,
you go down to the bottom of the sea and bring me some rocks.
Big Fish brought some rocks, and Raven sent him down for more. Then he sent him down for loads of gravel. And then for mud. With all this material, Raven gradually enlarged the point of rocks into a low island. Then he sent Big Fish after some big rocks. When he had brought these up, he seized his child and swam away to sea. Pretty soon, the moss began to grow and spread out. Soon the trees appeared and the rocks became mountain ranges. In this way, Raven built Alaska.
Ha! Ha!
Yeah.
things make this production different from your run-of-the-mill student play that is bound to be charming just because it's, you know, nice kids on the stage? Is there more to it?
I would say that you're talking about students who are, this is a chance, right, for Native people to express things that have been in them for a long time. First in taking legends and folk tales that have been confined on cassette tapes and on magazine projects and put away in libraries, get this stuff out, get it out. Few people in villages today, young people, know anything much about their own culture or stories. Through seeing this kind of thing dramatized, it really is an inspiration for other people to say, hey, maybe we should start doing this kind of thing too.
But you can see from the students that they, though they may not have been in touch with their culture before, they are now, and they start to remember things. They know how a crane walks. They've seen a crane walk. They've never thought about it before. And they've never thought about the bushes, or they've never thought about a raven flying. And when you talk about, well, this is what a raven looks like, they'll say, no, that's not what a raven looks like. They walk, if they fly this way, or a swan. So that once we get them started, they remember and then apply it.
Mm-hmm. Do you think it's changed the students that participated?
We had 13 shy students. Now we have 13 very verbal students, outward students. Yes, it's changed them a great deal. They're very proud of themselves. They were very successful. They think other students can be successful. Other students have asked to join this group. Yes, it's changed them.
A long time ago, a bird called Kupanak was flying around, having a good time. Then he thought to himself, it's such a nice day, maybe I'll just close my eyes and soar up into the air and fly as high as I can and then dive. The Kupanak started flying around, going up and down, just having a good time singing and laughing.
Kumbana, kumbana, mayugan na na joy ham. Kalanji, kalanji ham. Ye, 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 ye. Ye, 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 ye.
Then he thought he heard someone calling his name. So he opened his eyes and looked around. Kupanak said to himself, it couldn't be someone. There's no one around. Maybe I'm just hearing things. Well, I'll just keep on having fun. He closed his eyes and started to sing.
Kupana, kupana, mayuga na na joy han. Kalanji, kalanji hi. Ye, 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 je hi. Aak, hik, hik, hi. Ye, hik, hik, hi. Ha, 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 ha.
Again, he heard someone calling his name. He opened his eyes and looked around, but saw no one. If I keep one eye open, I'll see who has been calling me, Kupanak thought to himself. As he flew up into the clear blue sky, this time he kept one eye open, scanning the horizon and the land. Kupanak was singing louder than ever.
Kupanak, Kupanak, mayuga na na joy ham.
So suddenly from upon the loon surfaced from where he had been hiding. The loon looked straight up at Gopinath and started to sing.
Ellen Big Doom! Ellen Big Doom! Gopinath Sakhi! Gopinath Dahlan! Dahsuna Kasaka!
Seeing this, Gopinath screamed at the loon at the top of his voice. It was you all this time. I least expect you, loon. You know better than to call me names. It is wrong to call others names. Gopinath, angry at the loon, flew off toward the blazing sun and slowly disappeared. During that time, the loon watched motionless, ashamed of what he did to his friend Gopinath. He was about to dive when he noticed his long gaze towards the sun had turned his eyes and throat red. That is why to this day, all loons have red throats and eyes to remind them that they should never call others names.
And the success story goes even further from two unheralded performances kind of that got lost in the middle of a much larger week of Native affairs. Things have blossomed for you?
Oh, yes. We have commitments already for next year. We have commitments this year to go to Linfield, Oregon, to the Children's Theater Festival, a commitment to go to the International Linguistic Conference in Seattle, invitations to Sitka and Juneau and to Mount Edgecombe.
Jackson College in Sitka.
Shelton Jackson College in Sitka, and invitations to go into the Bethel area.
And also we had one this morning from Nome.
And one from Nome. That's for next year. But so it seems to be that what we've done is a communication system that is very acceptable to the people. Very, very acceptable.
Do you think an outside audience will react to it as warmly as an Alaskan audience that knows some of the background, knows a little bit about Eskimo dance and stories?
I think, yes, they will. The children at Linfield will definitely react to it because there are lots of fun things in the show that children will like. The stories are something that they can understand, that we have not designed stories that are only meaningful to a small group of people. In Seattle, the show in Seattle, I'm not sure. The only thing that I am sure of is that it's so unique, that the type of presentation, that most people are not aware of this type of dancing, and that we're traditionally used to watching the Sioux or the Navajo or the Zuni, but we've never seen Eskimo or Indian dancing in Alaska. So that the people outside will be just find that unique. They may not understand the stories or the reasons for the stories, but the uniqueness will make it accepted. But not accepted the same way I think that Native people accept what we did. That the Native people have a warmth that comes with, here are their children now telling the stories that they've known. And this is probably the first time in a long time that they've seen the children get involved, become interested. Mm. Well, Natives are very, very concerned. The older Natives are very concerned about their culture. They see that white society is moving in very quickly into villages and into some of the regions, and that the children who are going away to school, students to college and that, are losing it. They're adapting to a different cultural system, and they just don't want to see that happen. They think that their culture has something of value to it, and it does. It certainly does.
And yet, at the same time they want something to happen, how they attack what's going on around them is hard for them to take a grasp. Some way of combating these changes. They can be frustrated about it, but how do you do it? Mm-hmm. How do you combat it? And Duma Theater, I think you might look at it.
Just writing the stories down doesn't
no.
make it.
And that's the thing about the Duma Theater, that I think it came through with an answer.
It's the first viable answer
that anybody has had. And
it's
it was by
option.
Accident. It was by accident that it came about that way. That there was no experimentation that took place before. We had no idea how it would be accepted. But the reactions told us that we've hit on something is very valuable.
We hope that you've enjoyed what you've experienced so far. Our final stories address themselves to the land and its inhabitants. We will learn of the Tlingit and how they arrived, how the crane got his blue eyes, and how Little Diomede Island was formed. Come and join me as we listen to the tale of a mother to her daughter.
For my new basket, I shall use a sea wave pattern. This is an old, old pattern, older than the memory of the oldest grandmother. It shows something precious rising and falling on the waves.
Maybe it tells a story of how the Tlingit came to this country.
Oh no, that is not the way the Tlingit came to this land.
That's how my sister Sunkla and I came. But how did the oldest ones really come?
It is said that they came under a glacier that covered the whole of the Stikine in the very olden days. They were very brave people, those oldest ones. The story of their arrival comes to us from all grandmother of all grandmothers. In those days, the Tlingit had traveled many weary days, marches through long grass that cut and bit deep into their legs. When they came to the headwaters of the river, some of the people followed the streams down to the deep waters, some down the Nash River, some down the Unuk, our people down the Stikine, some down the Taku and the Chilkat, some down the Alsik, and last of all, down the Kop River. Some stayed at the mouth of the river, but others went further out among the island, even to the ocean itself. Some of your family went many, many miles clear to the Smoking Mountain near Sitka.
But how did they know they could go under the glacier?
I call them brave because they faced the unknown. They camped at the glacier place for a long time and could see that the streams disappeared under the ice. That was all they knew. Finally, an old man and his wife said, "We are old. We have lived our lives. Give us a canoe and we will go under the ice to see what is there." So the people gave the feast and a dance for the dead, and the old man and woman started down the streams while the people sang a song still remembered by us. The shaman made medicines the whole time they were gone, and his spirit told him that the old people had gone safely under the glacier to the other side. So the others began building canoe to follow them. Finally, one day the people saw them returning over to the top of the glacier. They reported that the water was swift but safe. All of the families then got into their canoe and went under the glacier until they met on the other side. And that is how we came to this place, which the oldest ones named Lake Shaped Like a Hip. There were so many of us that it was not possible for all to camp in the lower Stikine River, so we divided. Those who stayed in the upper camp came to be called Nanyani people, and those who went further out became the Outer Sand people.
A long time ago, Crane lived by herself on the tundra near Bethel, on the Kuskokwim River. Crane knew where some good, juicy berries grew. One morning, she awoke very hungry for some berries. She arose, stretched her long legs, and flapped her big wings. Up, up she flew on her way to the berries. Soon Crane found the berries. She flew down to the ground, then took out her eyes and put them on the stump.
Eyes, you watch for me. If you see anything coming, call me. I will not go far
away. Yes, master, I will watch for you.
Crane went fast to get to the berries. She ate some of the sweet, juicy berries. Then Crane's eyes began calling her.
Master, master, I see something coming this way. Please hurry, master, before it gets me.
Crane tried to run fast to her eyes. She put them on and looked all around. All she saw were some willows. Then she took out her eyes again and put them on the stump.
Don't fool me again. Call me when you really see something coming.
Crane went back to eat more berries. My, they tasted good. They tasted very, very good. Again her eyes called her.
Master, master, hurry, hurry. I see something coming.
Again Crane tried to run fast to her eyes. She put them on to see what her eyes had seen. All she saw was a log floating downriver. Crane once again took out her eyes.
You fooled me again! Be more careful before you call me!
She put her eyes back on the stump and went back to eat more berries. My, how sweet they tasted. Again her eyes began calling her.
Master, master, I see something coming. Please hurry, master. Someone has taken me away. Come, come and get me.
Oh, my eyes are probably fooling me again. I'm going to stay until I'm full. I mean, yeah.
So Crane went back and ate and ate. She ate all kinds of berries. She must have eaten every kind of berry there was. When she finally got full, she went back to the stump for her eyes, but could not find them. Her eyes were gone.
Oh my, my eyes are gone. How will I see now? I must find me new eyes.
Crane picked up two blackberries to use for her eyes. She put them on, and everything was black.
Oh my, I cannot see at all.
Crane took out the blackberries. Then she picked up two cranberries to use for her eyes. She put them on.
Oh my, everything looks red.
Crane didn't like that at all. She took out the two cranberries. Then picked up two blueberries to use for her eyes. She put them on, and she liked them. Everything was a pretty blue. She saw the blue sky and the blue water.
I will use these blueberries for my eyes. I like them.
That is how the crane got her blue eyes.
Thank you. very long time ago, there lived a mouse out in the country. After a very good night's sleep, he got up from the bed and started stretching himself up and down. Every time he put his arms up, he would touch the sky. He touched it several times. Finally, he said to himself, "Maybe if I cut down the pole, the sky would fall down and the people would think I am the greatest mouse there is in the whole wide world." So he started chewing on the pole that kept the sky up. He chewed and chewed. When the pole started swaying, he pushed the pole and ran to move out of the way. When he got quite a ways away from the pole, he looked back. A leaf lay fallen on the ground, not the sky. Then he noticed he was near a lake. He thought to himself, "If I swim this great big lake, surely the people will think I am the greatest." So he started to swim the lake until he reached the other side. When he got out of the water, he shook himself and looked back. From this angle, the lake looked like no more than a footprint of a human being. Then he noticed a mountain and thought to himself, "If I move this mountain, I shall be the greatest mouse in the whole wide world." So he started to dig and dig underneath the mountain until it was all cleared. It began to move. Step by step, he moved the mountain until at last he reached and shoved it into the ocean. There it still remains, known to people as Little Diomede Island.
Okay, we've talked about what the students that participated learned. What have you learned? Doug first, and then.
I've learned compassion from the students. I've learned how to work with students. I'm so used to working with majority students, with white students, that I've learned that students do desire direction. They do desire knowledge about things. That's not unusual for all students, but these people really did want to know how to do something and to do it well. I've learned a lot about villages. I've never been out in a village. I'm not like Josh that's had the opportunity. I've only been in Alaska a short time. So I've learned about villages, and I've learned about tradition that I didn't realize existed before, and how strong these kids feel about their homes and feel about their language, and that's an important thing. They do feel strong about their language. And I, of course, maybe have the white mentality of everybody has to speak English so we can be understood. But that's not necessary, and I learned that from my students.
Same question.
Yeah. I've learned that I have a lot to learn. I've always been pretty romantic about Native cultures, and I still have that side in me, which I still can't shake, and that comes to be a disadvantage sometimes when you're working in such a group as this. My initial approach was to let it come from them. I felt that they had the knowledge within them, and I didn't want to come on crushing them or telling them this is how it should be done, because then it would fall into the classic pattern of a non-native telling a native what to do, and especially in this situation, telling a native how to present his culture sounds very bad.
Why is being romantic about native culture a disadvantage?
I think you just you build up things in your mind that's in your mind's eye that is not necessarily true. It's not actually happening. That you have an image of that that some native people innately know about their culture, when in reality they don't know anything about their culture. It's a very sensitive thing, hard to describe. And when you find yourself the impetus of this force, this you're trying to say, hey, this is important. It's important you get up there and give statements in the opening of the show, because this is your chance to be you. You're not hiding behind a role or any image. This is you completely. And this is how you tell those people out there, hey, I'm proud to be somebody. I'm proud to be Native. This is where I come from. Or you level with them, I'm not proud. I'd like to learn how to be proud. And I've been taught not to be proud, but I want to learn how. And maybe standing in front of you, doing this theater, is I'll learn how to be proud and reopen what's been crushed and submerged by different influences.
And you think that's what happened?
For a lot of them, yes.
In days of old, our people were amazing, the way they led their lives in those days gone by. So it wasn't that their ways would sometimes lead them into conflict, even using bows and arrows. Yeah, 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 yeah.
They were heard. The Duma Theater performers were Chuna McIntyre from Eek, singer and Kopinar, Teresa John, Tuksuk Bay, singer and narrator, Nelly Aluska, Tununak, singer, guitar player, and crane, Vernon Chimgaria of Bethel, speaker, narrator, and Big Fish, David Epchuk, Kwithluk, speaker, Raven, Loon, and Mighty Mouse, Christine Andrews, Togiak, speaker, translator, and narrator, Pam Van Dyke of Beaver, speaker, and narrator, Kathy Lincoln, Tununak, speaker, storyteller, Maureen Mayo from Stevens Village, speaker, and eyes, Lucille Nelson of Bethel, speaker, storyteller, and Drina McIntyre of Ketchikan, narrator, and daughter. We also heard from Tuma Theater co-directors Doug Nancaro and Joshua Weiser. Production assistance for this program by Phil Falkowski. I'm Paula Schiller, and this has been a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks.